Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and I'm joined today by, well, we were supposed to be joined by Alan Bryan, but we have tonight Dan Patterson. Say hello.
I know you're very disappointed, but hello.
And now, is this John or is this Cameron?
This is John.
This is John, and we are joined by John Ontiveros. We should be getting... We're doing well, and we should be getting Cameron Sullivan along sometime soon. Dan will only be with us short for a little while, but that's fine. We're glad to have him for as long as he can be here. Our regular contributor, Alan Bryan, had to bow out at the last minute with a terrible migraine, so we wish him well. So, John, you're a first-time guest here, so why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm from Chicago. I am a big film buff. I think that's how we met. We met years and years ago in movie chat room when AOL was still a big thing.
I mean, it was like, what, like 2002 since we've known each other?
Oh, God. It had to be the early 2000s. We would stay up all night and just talk movies, old movies, new movies. And, I actually miss those times. It actually brings up a lot of old memories. So, from Chicago and just excited to talk about, the greatest science fiction movie, Star Wars. I'm very excited.
Yeah.
That's just a joke.
No. Actually, it's funny enough, we are doing a Star Wars show in July that I'm actually quite excited about for multiple reasons, not least of all is that we have a pretty special guest lined up for that episode that I wasn't sure I was going to get, but I was able to get him. Gentlemen, tonight we are discussing the landmark drama, The Sopranos. Now, let me ask you guys, would you say it is fair to describe television as being pre- and post-Sopranos? Dan?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, and John, what about you?
I definitely say yes. I think when you have something that's so influential, like Sopranos, like a Pulp Fiction, like a Honeymooners, you're just going to – it's an era. And there's a pre and post, definitely.
Yes, it absolutely is. I remember for me when I first saw this, the advertisements for, I was like, The Sopranos. I was like, what the hell is this going to be? And I said, oh, it's a mob thing, but it sounds like it's going to be like about singers or something. And I said, well, who's in the cast? I went, huh? Don't recognize a lot of these people. Because at that point they weren't showing a lot of Dominic Chianese, who played Dunkel Jr., who had been Johnny Ola in The Godfather Part 2. I did not, for some reason, recognize Edie Falco, who had just gotten off a 2 or 3 year stint on HBO's Oz, which is a great show, but pretty damn intense show if anyone's seen it. And
that was kind of a precursor to The Sopranos in its own way, as far as the HBO gritty drama.
Yeah, I was going to ask if either of you had seen that. So, Dan, you've seen that.
No, I haven't, but I've heard like all about it. That it's a very intense prison drama.
Yeah, it absolutely is. So, John, have you seen Oz?
No, I've heard of Oz, but I never have sat down to see any episode. So I had no idea who Edie Falco was. And also, I didn't watch The Sopranos until that last season.
I
basically watched the entire Sopranos series within 2 months.
You're not the only one.
Yeah, I was there from the beginning, and I remember, thinking, wow, this was amazing. Now, you know, the thing is The Sopranos is my number two show of all time. From the time that The Sopranos aired until the time around 2012, 2013, that I finally finished up The Wire, because I'd watched The Wire when it first aired, and then I had recorded the second season, and something happened to the videotapes. Yes, videotapes of that second season. And, of course, I couldn't – I was like, well, shit, it's a serial. I can't catch up. And it wasn't until, like, 2012, 2013 that I bought the full set. It was 2012, I remember now. And I caught up on it, and I was like, well, shit. After like 13 years, The Sopranos has finally been pushed to number two all time by The Wire. I hold The Sopranos in the highest regard. While I do think that The Wire is the best show ever made, I think The Sopranos, outside of maybe something like Twin Peaks, is the greatest artistic achievement for an ongoing series ever. And I wanted to get you guys' thoughts on that. Would you describe The Sopranos as just a great piece of entertainment, or would you describe it also as a great work of art? So, John, what do you think?
Definitely art. There are plenty of episodes where you leave and you are that is cinematic.
Hold that thought. We have a caller. I believe this is Cameron.
Yes, sorry for that.
Hi, Cameron. Yep. Everybody, this
Thanks
is Cameron Sullivan.
What up?
Right, thank you for inviting TV lovers everywhere.
So let John finish his thought. Sorry about that. Go on.
No problem.
Yeah.
And actually, it's great that you mentioned all three of those shows, because all those three shows are shows that everyone talks about as, you know, I mean, people shit on TV, which I don't necessarily agree with. But, you know, they do talk about those three shows as being on the same level as movies. And for me, I would say Sopranos is number one. That's just a personal preference. There are so many episodes, especially between seasons 2 and 5, where I was just in awe on how everything connects together, how the dialogue is perfect, all these characters that are just amazing all across. The dialogue, the direction, everything.
Oh yeah, it's a phenomenal show. I mean, you know, it's not just like the one-liners. Remember, like, what? No fucking ZD. But it's the dialogue, like where Angie Bumpensero talks about how she doesn't look forward to Sal coming home alive anymore. And at the end of that episode, Tony comes home from his trip to Italy. And he says, honey, I'm home. And there's this look on Carmelo's face. And it's that bit of acting and the way the director had the camera placed and the shot was set up that it's just phenomenal.
Exactly. And also, previous scenes of her trying to talk Angie Bonfacero out of getting a divorce and thinking those thoughts. When she mm-hmm. has those same exact thoughts, it's just—it's a marvelous show. It is both art and entertainment at its best.
Yep. So I will ask Cameron, our newest guest, where would you place The Sopranos? Would you place it more as entertainment, more as art, or as a perfect combination of both?
I think it's definitely the latter, just a perfect combo, where mm-hmm. it is trying to easily rival some of the best crime films of all time, while also just having its heart firmly in the balance of what's making this main protagonist, who's also technically an antagonist, tick. What's it like having to figure out, you know, what's going on inside his head when he goes to all his troubled counselor meetings? How does he handle his dysfunctional family, his strip club business, all his other rivals who want to try and ice him for various reasons? So If has anyone ever read the book Men in Hard Times? It's basically just a very cool book that just chronicles all this groundbreaking serialized television from the late 80s to today, including this one. And they pretty much talk about how HBO was still unsure on whether to air this because, you know, standards
yeah,
were different
I've
or not.
Yeah, I've read that book. That's a good one. I've also read Difficult Men, which was excellent as well.
Yeah, sorry, that's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah, Difficult Men.
No, believe it or not, there actually was one that was very similar. So you actually got a title. There's two books, Difficult Men. I second your recommendation on Difficult Men. If anybody can find a copy of it, should be available in paperback by now, I have to imagine, because it's been out, what would you say, about 6 years now, maybe?
It has to be, something like that.
Maybe 5 years, because it came out around the time, I think it came out around the time Breaking Bad was finishing up.
Something like that, yeah. It was like a year or so, but it's just amazing how this is often mentioned in the same sentence as various movies that people recommend, so that's pretty much building on the previous point. It's not only measuring up to be like a movie, but it pretty much has established itself to be mentioned by various movie lovers, and I think it's a testament also to just how everyone just trusted each other just so dearly. They literally did become a family. I still to this day am very disappointed how just some of the various actors that have had trouble in recent years just having as big a hit show as this. And it's like, because they're all just so incredibly gifted, you know? Eddie Falco's show Tommy just got canceled. I'm like, I could have watched that for 3 more years. She was great on this. She's great on everything.
Yeah, I actually have not seen Nurse Jackie yet. So, you know, but but that's something that is on my never-ending list of to-see shows. So,
yeah.
So I had you guys get into some questions to mull on before the show, and I'm going to start with you, Dan. Let's start with this one. What was your of all the episodes on, or not all the episodes, but all the storylines on the show? What was your least favorite storyline, Dan?
Least favorite? I don't know if I hate the storyline, but it's the one that like sticks out like a sore thumb as like really kind of, I don't want to say unnecessary, but just it's gonna be like Vito in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's kind of like I get what they were doing, but I don't think it quite works in the narrative whole.
Yeah, there were a lot of episodes, there were two storylines that season that got a lot of flack that in that sixth season, well officially season six Part A, according to HBO, Season 6, according to David Chase, and let's defer to David Chase. I'd have to say that storyline. Would you say it's fair that the biggest problem with that was that it went on far longer than it needed to tell the story that it did?
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. That was the problem with my storyline, which was also in that season, which is where Tony is shot by Uncle Junior and ends up basically living another life while he's in a coma, and it just goes on for like 3 or 4 episodes, and it could have easily been done in like an episode and a half.
See, I kind of like those, to be honest. Those I don't have a problem with. It was just, I guess, the whole Vito and Maine thing, because the show is about Tony and his supporting cast around him. And when you get out of New Jersey, it just feels really out of place.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, and what bothered me about the storyline that I disliked, it wasn't that there was anything wrong with it in and of itself. It's that, for me, it just took too long and went over and over making the same damn point. I mean, maybe the point was that Tony was never going to learn anything. Even being on death's doorstep wasn't going to teach him anything. But, you know. Cameron, what about you? What is your choice for your least favorite storyline?
I didn't really have a least favorite storyline, but I did have an issue with the episode. That's the one with the Russian in the winter. I just didn't understand. Not only did the episode, I just didn't think anything really got accomplished there.
Yeah, you're talking about Pine Barrens, which that's an episode that actually is one of my favorite episodes, maybe because it's so unusual. But that's
fine.
Oh, yeah,
no, I didn't think it was poorly made. No, it just...
No, I was going to ask. I actually really like it. Expound on that. You said that you felt it was disconnected.
Not necessarily disconnected. I just didn't really feel like anything really got the point of the episode. Then, you know, well done on that front. I just kind of felt I did like Christopher and, you know,
Polly
and companies. Polly Walnut's bickering. But it was kind of one of those where it's just like I didn't really know what they were going for. I could probably rewatch and see. I just. Seeing how the fans and writers argued over it endlessly, I was like, "What's the deal?"
Yeah, no, it's definitely an episode. And that one, I believe, was directed by John Buscemi, who later on showed up as Tony Blundetto in season 5.
Right.
That one, that is one that fans and critics they either really love it or they kind of have a similar response to you, like. Well, what's its purpose? Why is it here? So, John, what about you? What is your least favorite storyline?
To add to Pine Barrens, it didn't make my top five, but it's definitely a great episode, and it's just the relationship between Polly and Christopher. I mean, just that alone. That relationship was it's iconic, especially in the Sopranos world. And I think it didn't really add to.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship and just. Hello?
Yep. So I thought that Blog Talk had gone out for a second. I heard a beep and. I'm glad everybody's still there. Technical glitches,
yeah.
Folks. Live radio.
Well, yeah, okay. So I could watch Paul and Christopher all day, all night. So the story, I had trouble with finding a storyline that I just, you know, really didn't care for. And I guess I came up with AJ's relationship with the girl with the eating disorder towards the end. And the reasoning is kind of weak. I just was tired of the AJ story by then, where I almost wish they would have just left him in the hospital and just kind of moved on with the family. Just by that point, I was just kind of done with AJ. It too annoying, too much, and I actually just didn't want to hear from him at that point.
Is that where AJ ended up trying to kill himself?
That is after. This is where he admitted to it's not a mental hospital. This is after he committed suicide. He was admitted to the hospital, and he meets an old friend who's, I think she might even be underage at that point. And you know, they go out and they go out in his truck, and AJ's parking, and he blows up his own car. And... No one remembers.
Mm-hmm. Just very vaguely, you know, it probably speaks to how weak a storyline it was. It also speaks to how, while I think The Sopranos was never a bad show, I do think that final batch of episodes was a little uneven for some of the personal stuff. I think the overarching plot, the mob stuff, was great, but some of the personal stuff didn't feel as thought out.
It definitely, original. It just got a little repetitive, especially with AJ.
Yep. So, you know, keeping this moving along, Dan, what's the character that you most identify with on the show?
It's a cross between Tony and AJ in a lot of things.
And why is that?
I mean, I feel like he's a fairly great character that anyone can identify with him. Especially therapy, because I actually had a stint in therapy for a hot minute, and that I really related to. I'm very much Tony Soprano when I'm being analyzed. Also with AJ, just the whole coming-of-age storyline that's going on, like that, I very much related to too, even though, like, he can be annoying at times. I feel like that's the point, because most young men are annoying in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of people want to or can identify with Tony, you know, despite how horrible so many of his actions are. You know, he also has a lot of very basic, very human and almost admirable traits in that he just wants to, you know, provide for his family. He wants to have a safe place. He'd like to have a family that cares for him, for himself, rather than what he can do for them without having to worry about getting killed if he makes anybody angry. You know, he's a very identifiable character, I think, in that sense. So, Cameron, what about you? Of all the characters on this show?
By all means, I really think this is one of the better multi-character dramas. And going back to your earlier point, I don't really feel like, even though there's some inconsistency in certain episodes, I will give them props for surviving, you know, multiple writer strikes and keeping the show on the road. But while Tony's ambitions are relatable and the actual character he is isn't, I kind of relate the most to Christopher, if you will. I think we can all kind of at one point or another relate to how he's trying to get out of the slump that he's in. He wants to be something bigger than he can actually be. He's got unrealistic expectations. He's arrogant, but he's got heart when he's not, you know, killing people at, you know, for Tony or cheating at the card game. So, I mean, it's just the episodes where he meets Jon Favreau, who's starring as a fictional version of himself, and he's trying to sell a script to him. And Favreau's getting all very disturbed by all these very realistic, you know, based on actual incidences that he's describing. It's just kind of a testament to how he still is never going to be able to escape his current place. And so it was just a very fascinating alternate storyline because, I mean, when you first start out, he's already getting pushed around by Tony saying, hey, you know, I'll make you a man like me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the show, he's pretty much burnt out, but still surviving, and it's just a very much like how Falco's portrayal of Carmella inspired a lot of actual real life mafia wives. I can see a lot of ex-cons relating to Christopher, or just everyday Joes who have heard or had friends who were in tough, you know, inner city neighborhoods. Just an alternate arc. He's kind of the Tony Almeida of 24 of this show. He's kind of the guy who the story kind of focuses on when it's not focused on Tony and family. So.
Yeah. So, to you, John, which character did you most identify with?
Well, the two previous guests took my one and two, so I'm going to go in a different direction and just go with an underappreciated Carmella Soprano, because, I mean, we are talking about the Sopranos, and everyone is just going to talk about the guys, right? But one of the most fascinating anything about the Sopranos is just how Carmella basically runs her family like a mob boss, whether she's stealing money or she's threatening a lawyer to get a letter written for her daughter to get into college, or she's sneaking into Bird Feeder to get money to invest for money for herself. I mean, she runs that family. No matter what Tony says or does, I mean, she winds up getting, I forget the exact number, I think it's $600,000 to get back together with Tony. And she was the big winner in that, and I think it's just such an underappreciated storyline. I mean, everyone knows about it, but Edie Falco is just unbelievable in this show. She's great. No wasted scenes. I love the scenes in the early seasons with the priest, and
yeah,
then with the short affair with the painter from a family, a brother of a family friend. I mean, I love her character. I love her acting. I love everything, almost everything with her in it.
Yeah,
very cool.
Well, I mean, I think Falco and Gandolfini, they each won, what, 4 lead actor and actress Emmys for this show. I mean, it's quite a remarkable run.
And I had no idea about any. I don't have any idea who won awards for this. But much deserved for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a great character story as much as it is, you know, a plot about mob wars and resentments. You know, and I think that the fact that Tony's in therapy is not coincidental, because it really is a kind of a deconstruction of the mob and the cycle of American work and labor at the end of the 20th century.
Right. Lots of imagery and illusion.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, I mean, Tony said it to Tony said something that can apply to a lot of people. He said, you know, it's always best to come in on the ground floor. And I get that you can't always do that, but lately I'm getting the feeling that I came in right at the end. And I think that's an anxiety that a lot of people have, that the best times are over, that there's no hope for the future, that no matter how much effort they put in, it's not going to matter. And, you know, that's carried through the whole show, that fear, and you know, it's not just in Tony, it's in Carmela too. And you know, John, you mentioned some of the things that Carmela did, and Carmela, you know, still has one of the best lines I've ever heard on television, where she's talking to Tony about getting Meadow into college, and she says, it's not about how good your grades are, it's not about how much money you have, it's about who the fuck you know and whose dick you sucked. And Tony just kind of looks at her in bed, and I'm thinking to myself, well, yeah, you know, she's not wrong. you know, and it's not even so much that the world has changed as much as that the world has become more of what it's always been. And
right.
The Sopranos is very realistic in terms of how it reflects that. So
right.
So I did want to get into, and here's something a little fun now. So before we get into some more of the headier stuff later, and I'll start with you, Dan. Do you have a top 5 list ready?
I'm at a top 1, and then I can talk about other episodes I really like. The only one that I can say is guaranteed favorite, yes, is The Test Stream, which ironically enough is the most divisive episode of the series.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, I guess I really like the cliche choices of college, which I think for most people was the episode where Sopranos really became a great show. Like, if you're not hooked by that point, I would say there's no hope in you liking the show. I really do like Pine Barrens, even though I do agree as to why some people might not like it. I really like Employee of the Month, just because I think that was the episode where David Chase really told the audience, I'm not here to satisfy you. And
yeah.
I really like the series finale. I think it's one of the greatest series finales ever.
So if I had a top five right now, I would have to rewatch the show to come up with a more comprehensive list. But as of now, that's my top five.
Very good. Very good. So what about you, Cameron? What are your choices?
Top five, I'm pretty much also tied with the college episode. Just a good deconstruction of loyal to his daughter, wants her to succeed at everything, and yet will do lots of his usual shady stuff behind her back. Literally. And
yep.
The pilot episode is honestly one of the best introductions to a show I've ever seen. It just instantly gets you into the thing. It's so consistent with what comes later, and it's just very well shot, and you can't look away. You're like, did he just kick a guy out in front of all these other people and then get back in his car? Like, no problem.
Yep, he did.
And then I'd tie that with Mikey Palmisi's first episode, Phil Leotardo's first episode. I mean, both those actors, Al Sapienza and Frank Vincent, always so underused. And they're just absolutely just giving career best performances because, you know, Mikey is just an absolute psycho. He thinks he's kind of more sociopathic, but no, he's just an absolute guy who just gets off on just causing everyone to just be tortured and realize that he's in control of them. And with Phil, he's all about, you know, just avoiding border wars and just letting everyone know that he's not going to put up with their shit. He is the king of the street as far as he's concerned. And he just adds so much extra life to what could have easily, you know, fallen victim to just villain of the season, you know, or villain of the week territory, and it's such a key role, and he gives it his all.
Yeah, and Frank Vincent, you know, he, you know, the thing is, he's such a great actor, and when you hear him talk about things off screen, he seems like he's probably, or was a pretty great guy, but damn, if that wasn't a booable, hissable character. I mean, it's a great character, but Phil was the perfect son of a bitch for those last few seasons of the show.
Pretty much. He was always dissecting everybody, not literally, but just verbally, just being like, do I look like I owe you anything? And I think he says at one point, and I thought that was a powerful line, is like, yeah, he really doesn't owe anyone anything. And then to finish it off, I believe the season 3 finale where Big Pussy, you know, gets disposed of on Tony's private boat by him and Holly.
Yeah, that's season 2, Funhouse.
My bad, yes. Season 2 finale, and it's just, you can't look away. You're like, holy shit, you know, he's already failed to be a proper, you know, witness to the feds and all these other guys, and after all he's done, he thinks he can just walk in there and make things right, and that they're already there, ready to gun him down.
Yep. So, finally to you, John, what are your top five?
Yeah, actually, Funhouse is my number one. What an intense episode. I mean, what an intense way to end that season. I mean,
yeah.
You could see how close they were together. They're pouring tequila together. You know he's dead. He's dead. I mean, once he's on the boat, he's dead. And just Pussy asking to sit down, and it's so intense. It's so hard to watch. It is actually,
right,
like, really hard to watch because you feel bad for Pussy. But, yeah, that was my number one. One episode that I love just because I think it explains Tony in a nutshell is, it's in season 5. I think the episode is called Cold Cuts. And it's the episode where at the beginning Tony's sister gets into a fight at a soccer game. And so Tony comes by and he's yelling at his sister and you know, he has a talk with the husband outside and they're yelling back and forth, and he's like, don't you care about Sophia, my daughter? And he's like, he basically says no, but then he corrects himself, which he almost never does. But in that moment, like, he corrected himself right away. He's like, okay, I do. But you got to get control of your wife. And it was just, it was one of those moments where, like, I could not believe, like, he's actually going to back up and be like, okay, maybe that was too far. Like, Tony Soprano going too far. He does it.
Well, once,
and then
Frankenstein.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
He's kind of like Frankenstein. He just has two different sides. He's Dr. Jekyll when he's on the job, and he's Mr. Dr. Hyde when he's off and dealing with family.
Yeah, I mean, you know. No, I was going to say that's actually, you know, that Tony is a lot different in his personal life than he is in his professional life. And his personal life gets fucked up when he tries to still be the mob guy instead of just Tony.
Right. Because he is so charismatic. Carmella says it. He's bigger than life. And that's if he wasn't in the mob, just who he is as a person and how he can be so personable. He's bigger than life. He's this big teddy bear who could be like a little boy, as Dr. Melfi would say.
Right.
But in that same episode, the end, he shows how mean he could be at the family dinner. So he sees his sister. She's doing some kind of therapy where she's trying to control her anger, and she's actually got in control of it. She makes a nice dinner. Everyone's enjoying it. Everyone's happy. Tony can't stand it. So he basically makes fun of Janice's inability to be a mother, where he makes that joke in French in front of everybody. That was one of the cruelest things I've ever heard in movies, TV's, books. It was such a dagger to the eyeball. It was terrible. But that always struck with me. He leaves the house and he walks alone and he's there by himself. I think at that point he's still divorced. It's just, that one stuck with me. Really quickly, I love the episode where they went to Italy in season 2.
Commendatory.
Yeah, a lot of funny stuff with that. And then what was another one? Also, love the episode in season 3 where Ralphie kills his mistress stripper girlfriend who's pregnant with his baby. I mean, talk about out of control, where he's, you know, twirling his whatever pool stick and bike chain at the one guy who works at the bar. Just that episode just stuck with me, how just nonchalant his evilness was.
And Joe Pantoliano played that to the hilt.
Oh my God, he's an unbelievable actor, and he's lasted 30, 35, 40 years, and he's not many people even know his name, and he's so great. He's so great.
I mean, you know, the thing is I still remember him. You know, I mean, he's been in so many things, but he was in Midnight Run with
yes,
De Niro.
The bail bondsman.
As the bail bondsman. Yep. And for any of our listeners out there, if you like mob stuff at all, and you probably do if you're listening to this episode, and you haven't seen Midnight Run, do yourself a favor, find a copy and watch it.
I highly agree.
It's wonderful.
Moments of the show. Can I just mention that what I find in Sopranos as far as fans' reception to it? It's one of the few shows I can think of where everyone has drastically different opinions of what the highs of the show are. Like, I feel like most shows, like, even if you don't agree on what the best season, you can agree on, like, where the peaks of the show are. Like, most people will say the peaks of Seinfeld are season 3 to 7. Some people will say the peaks of The Wire are season 3 and 4. But when you talk about Sopranos fans, like, it really varies. Like, some really love the first few seasons and think it peters off near the end, and some people think it just keeps getting better and better. The only
of people just infects them in different ways, and it could be a testament to the quality of both shows, but...
Yeah, well, I think that they're all really great shows, and for me, of those shows, you know, I think The Sopranos and Breaking Bad probably had, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, and Mad Men, they all, like you said, they seem to really divide fans. And but for me, I think that they all have, you know, they all have that one season where you kind of go, yeah, shit, that's an off season. But none of them for me, and this is just me. None of them for me have a whole period where it's like, okay, they've lost me. But that's just me. But you know, you're right. I mean, you know, look at Breaking Bad. I mean, you know, Breaking Bad. I do know some people that really actually didn't like any of the stuff after Gus was gone. But mostly people consider those last two batches of episodes to be the best the show was ever at. You know, now most people will say that Mad Men probably peaked in season 4 or 5. But we'll also agree that season 6 and 7, parts 1 and 2, were pretty good. But The Sopranos is a funny creature. Like you said, you know, a lot of people really love the first 2 or even 3 seasons. People don't seem to talk a lot about seasons 4 or 5. But then everybody has opinions on those last 2 seasons, maybe because of the least favorite storylines that we talked about earlier. So yeah, that's an interesting point.
Yep.
So I'm going to move this along to this question. What do we think that the main theme of the show was? Let's go with you, Dan. What do you think the main theme of this show was?
Everyone sucks and we all die.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was more than that, but I feel like what I got most out of it was just the personal relationship between people. And all the people were around and being kind of selfish and manage, and just, even when you're on top, you just end up dying away.
So Cameron, what do you think the show's main theme was?
I think the main theme, based on how every post season 1 season kind of starts off with various montages and opera music playing and noirish kind of look, it's kind of always reestablishes that no matter whether you're at the top of your game or the bottom of your life, let alone your career, life goes on, and you have to try and take control of that. And like you say, I mean, Tony just kind of keeps, all these various characters kind of keep trying, only to keep being disappointed. And we view their various ambitions and disappointments, you know, from third-person perspective.
Yeah. Now, I think that's interesting that you said that, because consider what you just said in light of the way that the series finale abruptly ends.
Right. Kind of reinforced.
And I think that really does, you know, help your case for that being a good theme for the show. So John, what about you? What do you think the show's main theme was?
I'm gonna have to say family, just like Godfather, and its overarching of just themes of betrayal, loyalty, and all that. I think. You know, the point of things moving on is definitely a huge theme. And just a lot of the ending episodes are, it goes back to Tony not wanting his family to basically leave him, whether it's the ducks or thankfully, being at Artie's restaurant in a rainstorm and just being able to be with his family for that hour. That hour makes all the killings and the criminal activity worth it. Where he's more at peace when him and his family are happy and they're at a table eating. So yeah, I would say family.
Mhm. And finally, for now, before we get into the last major question, that we're gonna have some fun after this. Dan, what has this show meant to you? What has this show meant to you?
The show has essentially meant that you can be captivating and use your edgy and stylish nature in which you deliver the story in the best possible way, you know? And, I mean, this is very much like how I rank, you know, Better Call Saul and The Wire. It's just they're continually letting their quiet moments just be well utilized. They're letting their more explosive moments also just advance the storyline instead of just be cheap shock value. You can tell how much thought and outlining of each season has been put to use. And you can tell that this is also just a good way to just have a gripping crime saga where when it's not about all the guns, drugs, and money and, you know, fighting off the feds, that at the end of the day, it's all about how do we chronicle the sanity and day-to-day look at the actual people themselves.
Mm-hmm.
To believe that it, you know, worked for this long and started rivalries with all these other shows is also a testament to how just enormously fascinating it is.
And finally to you, John, what has the show meant to you?
Just that TV can just be as good as movies. I think some of the failure I don't want to use that word lightly, but some shows like, say, Lost. I personally love Lost until that last season. Mm-hmm. It just never ended. So when I think about Lost, I'm like, it was a failure because it didn't come together. But The Sopranos was at such a high level for so long throughout every season, even the stuff that we didn't consider as good as the previous seasons, like season 5 and 6 maybe. But just that there are TV shows that can be as good, but you're not going to know until they're ended. Like right now I'm watching, I don't know if you guys are watching Killing Eve.
I've only seen the first season and the first episode of the second season. I need to get back to it. But yeah, I know what you're talking about, so go on.
I think it is fantastic. I'm almost at a point where like they probably need to end next season because I don't know how it's going to keep up at the same level. But there are definitely shows out there now that are pushing the levels where TV is, people are starting to talk about TV shows as good as some of the better movies in movie history. So Sopranos just kind of upped the game for other TV shows to kind of shoot for that higher level.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, and I think it's interesting you mention The Sopranos in connection to movies because, you know, I think The Sopranos is easily better than a vast majority of mob movies and a vast majority of dramas over the last, say, 20 years or so. It's really, really special. But if you remember when it came out and then about 10 weeks after it was released, because it was released in the early part of January of 99, and then in the late March of 99, Analyze This came out with Robert De Niro and Billy Crystal, and it was about this mobster that went into therapy. And a lot of people started looking at The Sopranos as somehow being this ripoff of Analyze This. Well, if anything, Analyze This kind of ripped off The Sopranos because Chase's script had lingered around Hollywood for a while before HBO picked it up. Ramis wrote the script really quickly, put it in, and put it together. Now, I'm not accusing Harold Ramis of anything. I don't want anybody out there to think I'm accusing anyone of anything because I'm not. I'm just saying that logically, this is why I've always thought the accusations were bullshit. Because there's no way that they influenced each other other than maybe someone had said to someone, hey, you know, what about this idea of like a mobster in therapy, which actually it has to have been like an old joke somewhere years ago, and someone finally just picked up on it. But, you know, it was unfairly looked at as, you know, a Goodfellas knockoff, an Analyze This knockoff. And I think the fact that it endured proves that it's not. And by the way, I do think that Analyze This actually was a decent little movie. And, rest in peace Harold Ramis, who was one of the all-time great comedy writers.
There was a great joke in Analyze This, in The Sopranos?
One at a time.
So, first guy?
Oh, I was going to say there was a great joke in season two when Tony tries to see another therapist and the therapist turns him down because he knows Tony's a mobster and he tells him, I've seen Analyze This, and Tony just responds, isn't that a comedy?
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
It's a fucking movie.
I think this just kind of mirrors the whole Babylon 5, Deep Space Nine endless arguments. It's just all a matter of, is like, you know, ideas circulate all the time. People take stuff out of there despite signing all these NDA forms, and they just want to make stuff that's similar because I actually spoke to a director of an infamous action movie, and he talked about how just they still do this today, how it's just they'll sign up an actor based on how their previous movie does, but it's very crappy because if they're newest movie doesn't do well, then they don't want them in their next one. It's like this, there's stuff all the time that's not the most organized, but people are always trying to predict success and it's very easy for there to be a knockoff title because they're just like, this is the year that we're going to do, you know, Cowboys, this is the year we're going to do Asteroids, this is the year we're going to do, you know, people stuck in a White House. There's always just various formulas that everyone floats around, and sometimes it's even the same studios or sister companies doing it because they want to share that combined success.
Yeah. Now, actually, it's interesting you mentioned Babylon 5, Deep Space Nine, because although no one likes to talk about it, there actually was eventually a court settlement about a plagiarism case. And there were a lot of NDA signed. Straczynski, who loves to talk about things, won't talk about it because he's honoring the NDAs. But apparently what happened, my understanding is that Michelle Barrett intervened and reading between the lines, she basically went to Paramount and said, you guys are besmirching the legacy of Gene's franchise by ripping this man off. Now we're going to make it right. And Paramount executives were feeding ideas from the original Babylon 5 story Bible to the showrunners of Deep Space Nine, and that eventually had to stop. But yeah, but I think both shows are incredible. I love Babylon 5, and I think that Deep Space Nine is the best of the later Trek series.
Yeah, but I mean, it gets even more complicated when you realize they share so many cast and crew also between each show. So I mean,
yeah, it really does. It really does. So, you know, but getting back to the Sopranos, you know, we've talked about all these other things, all these major big things. So what about some of the characters that we, like, you know, we haven't talked about? So is there a character that any of us think maybe is underappreciated? This can be somebody that maybe was just a recurring character or somebody that was a regular character. Dan, anyone that comes to mind? I think Dan has left us. So,
Oh,
shit. we will go to back to you, Cameron. Are there any characters that you have that you would like to put a spotlight on that don't get talked about as much for The Sopranos?
I really don't see anyone mention Meadow, the daughter. It just seems like she's like the only character who is able to stay the most pure, stay out of trouble, and probably one of the few times where you have a kid in a, you know, a movie for adult, a show for adults who's not annoying and who was not really even all that ego-headed. But most of the time, she's just being very keeping to herself, trying to see if she can have a life outside of this bizarre family.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she went through her stupid teenager phase, but it wasn't anything unbelievable or anything that was super annoying.
Right, or, oh, good grief, here we go again. You know, this was kind of like, Dad, why'd you kick my boyfriend's dad's ass, so he broke up with me.
Yeah, or, oh, my God, you and Mom won't let me go to Aspen. And you're thinking, you entitled little girl. But, you know, but it's not, oh, my God. It's not to the point that, you know, it got for, let's go back to Babylon 5 for a minute, where Straczynski said, kids are so poorly handled on television, and especially in science fiction, there's going to be an edict. No kids are cute robots. Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't accuse Meadow of being an annoying kid. You know, she had her flaws, and she was very human. So what about you, John?
I don't think we've brought up Silvio.
Yeah, Silvio's great.
Probably the most stable and sane character on the mob side. And what's great about Silvio is, besides him being in the Bruce Springsteen band, is he was a great number two. He was a great, great number two, and he had that one chance to take over for Tony when he was in his coma, and he totally fucked up. Like, he just could not handle the pressure. He couldn't deal with it, and he said it himself, some people are just meant to be number twos, and he was definitely a number two. But, I mean, he was just such a great character. And
yeah, and he learned to be happy at being number two.
Yeah, and I think that's what made him sane. He was comfortable with his position. He was in power, but he, you know, he didn't need to flaunt it, and people respected him. And he was, yeah, great number two. And then also Artie. Artie is
Artie was
great great. I mean, there's, you know, there's obviously great characters throughout, but Artie is such a good, what's weird to me is this is one of the few, like, little minor fuck-ups in The Sopranos. I don't think his character was thought ahead, because in the beginning, the first three or four episodes, they almost make it seem like Tony and Artie are old school friends, but they're not. They weren't really friendly at that time. And
no.
You know, throughout the rest of the show, you know, they've been best buddies forever. But love all the Artie. I love the Artie stuff where he gets into it with what's the kid's name from Doogie Howser.
Max Casella's character, the one that works for
Max
Christopher's crew, yeah.
Right. I think that whole, his jokes in front of Tony and Max at dinner what was her name? It was similar to Martini, but he used her name, the girlfriend. I died laughing. I could not stop laughing at that moment. And I just love Artie.
Oh, John Ventimiglia was a treasure on the show. I mean, he was a real secret weapon, you know?
Yeah, he was definitely one of those guys where, you know, in his younger days, he probably was a stud and always tried to get back to that. He had a thing for Adriana. He had a thing for the host he hired from another country. I mean, funny
mm-hmm.
character.
Very well said. Artie is definitely one of those guys who, I mean, just the scene where he holds Tony, you know, at gunpoint with a shotgun, and he's like, "Did you burn down my restaurant?" And you know, Tony totally hired someone to do that as part of his gang wars, and you know, because it was like owned by one of his rivals. I think it was Uncle Junior or somebody. I can't remember, but it's like he flat out has to. You know, he could easily lie and do a really shitty job, but like Tony literally does think he's going to actually get gunned down. It's one of his few cowardly moments. And he's just like,
right?
No. No, I no no
no I no, no. Artie, are you crazy? Me? You think I walked to the corner and put a match to Vesuvio? Me? I would do such a thing? I never did that. And technically, he was telling the truth. He never did it. As you recall,
right.
He had Silvio do it.
Right.
Right.
And Silvio, going back to him, was another just brilliant casting, just along with, I'd rank him with any character that you'd see a singer like Mick Jagger or David Bowie portray. It just, you know, they weren't acting full time, but they were pretty naturally good at it. And even Richard Belzer, the comedian's portrayal of Detective Munch on those various crime shows, you know, it just kind of ranked with that. It's like, man, that was, I don't know who decided to do that casting, but damn, that was really good.
I mean, think about it. We haven't even brought up Johnny Sack or Richie Aprile.
No. And Johnny, now Johnny was a great character. And, you know, one of the things that I liked about Johnny is they had him really, really, really devoted to his wife. And his wife was a great character. You know, here's a character where she's overweight. And a mob war breaks out basically because he defends his overweight wife to a jackass.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's always out of control. I will say Uncle Junior was very well cast. Dominic Chianese from Godfather 2, that was an inspired choice. And to just have him kind of just be the more kind of just laid back, more secretive, sneaky, you know, gangster, while having way worse problems than, you know, in an old folks home, and while also flirting with Tony's mother is like, damn, that that guy was ballsy at every turn, you know.
Yeah.
Say hi to your mother for me, you know.
Yeah, I just found out today that the character who played Albert Barisi was in Godfather 3.
Oh, really?
Yes, he was one of the one of Joe Mantegna's henchmen.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah. I mean, there are even, yeah, I think even Johnny and, yeah, a few other guys were even extras in The Godfather. So, yeah, they definitely share a lot of the same cast.
And, that's fun to have all these references to mob movies and some of these old faces that, I mean, you didn't really hear from Dominic Chiesi since Godfather. I know he was in the Gotti made-for-television movie, but I haven't heard from him since Godfather.
Well,
too.
he had a recurring, or actually not so much a recurring role. He was actually a pretty much a regular or semi-regular for the first two or three seasons of Boardwalk Empire, which Scorsese produced, and Terrence Winter, a regular writer and producer on The Sopranos, created and was the head writer on. He played the lawyer for not for Nucky's organization, but for the guy that was the power behind Nucky's power.
Gotcha. Yeah.
There you go. I think it got into two episodes of Boardwalk Empire and kind of gave up on it.
Yeah, Boardwalk Empire is, it's a show that I like, but I never quite loved it. I think that, you know, people expect it to be The Sopranos, and I don't think it was ever going to be The Sopranos. And it was much more somber and wistful show, and I don't think that people were ready for what it wanted to do. Though it did provide Michael K. Williams with a great role as Chalky White.
He was good on it. I think the main draw for me, I guess, was Michael Shannon's troubled detective. He's a despicable lowlife who really is really good at just, you know, doing a measuring contest with all these, you know, creeps and criminals. And I think it just kind of was all kind of a little over the place for me, but I did share a lot of the same.
Well, Michael Shannon
and
the guy that played Capone, I forget his name. He's an English actor. They were the two best parts of that whole show for me. Well, actually, three, if you count Michael K. Williams as Chalky.
Yeah, fair enough. That kind of gave a semi-launch to let's have a lot of Sopranos-type shows, but have them set in, you know, 20s and 30s, you know, era shows. I mean, then you got Pinky Blinders and a bunch of these other shows. And Sopranos still, I see the formula continually, you know, imitated. There was a few other shows like that. There's been a bunch of cartel shows lately, some based on real events. There's been it was either DirecTV or AT&T before they bought the other show called Ice, which was kind of the same kind of concept, all these guys trying to make one last gamble and swindle a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very Sopranos inspired.
I was going to ask, you know, where do we really place this show all time? As I said myself earlier, I think it's the second greatest TV program of all time. So what about you, John? Where do you place it all time?
I'm going to have to place it at number one, and the reason is just based on that I can always put on a scene or put on an episode. I've already watched it three times over. And I was on my fourth time, and Amazon had just taken it off Amazon Prime because HBO started their own channel. So I was you know, during the Richard Prio episode, I was getting really into it. I loved it. I could listen to it and be happy. You can just always go to that. And, I mean, I love a lot. I love The Wonder Years, and I love Breaking Bad. But I don't think I could rewatch those like I rewatched Sopranos. I mean, I would lose sleep and just watch Sopranos. Like, it's that good. It's like a movie that you. It's like for me, Pulp Fiction. I could watch Pulp Fiction any day of the week. It's just so rewatchable.
Yeah, it's a great, great, great program. Absolutely. And like I said, you know, for me, it's my second program of all time. But if somebody wanted to say, hey, no, you're wrong, The Wire can't be anything better than the second best because The Sopranos absolutely is, I'd say, well, who knows? Maybe it is just my opinion. But, you know, like I said, The Sopranos, The Wire, toss a coin. 9 times out of 10, I'm going to choose The Wire. But the Sopranos, I think The Sopranos is pretty much the greatest artistic achievement television has yet seen. So it's a remarkable show.
I actually just watched The Wire. And, again, I was lucky enough to, you know, just hear about it, that it was great. Sat down and probably watched all The Wire within maybe 2.5 weeks. And just the concept of going into a major city and going through the streets, the police, the media, you know, every season's different. And again, the characters are so rich. Definitely The Wire is phenomenal. And you can't go wrong. Yeah. You flip a coin, you're going to be happy. Great, great show.
Yeah, it absolutely is one of my, you know, my all-time favorite things ever on or off of TV. So what about you?
I definitely share your sentiments. I could put on an episode of The Sopranos at any time, but I'm definitely more partial to The Wire and just a few other just kind of psychological kind of shows, even Oz, and Deadwood, NYPD Blue. I just kind of just liked a lot of just other kind of serialized shows that really just played with just various people's personal issues as well as just allusions to real life and how the show's commentary on that. But yeah, The Wire was really just fascinating with how like each season was a totally different perspective of Baltimore. You know, like season one is the whole Stringer Bell, season two is the whole, you know, who are the
dock workers,
low lives and criminals.
Death of work.
Yeah, at the port and the more police politics. Season three pretty much just shows how there's new faces in town and more tragedy besetting. And season four discusses just how the school system is totally failing. And I think I just about cried at that. It was just so realistic.
God, that whole storyline from seasons four and five with those kids, you know, to quote Orson Welles about Make Way for Tomorrow, it could make a stone weep.
Pretty much. And season five deals with just how the news media will jump on anything without checking their sources. And I think something that I mainly go back to more than anything probably has to be the Shield or the West Wing. Those share a lot of the same kind of filmmakers with all of these shows, but I mean, like, The Shield and Wired both did a good job at saying, hey, we're not going to just be another gangster show, but we're also not going to be just another cop show either. We're going to just detail this whole rich new environment that we created, and you're going to follow us on these various adventures. And West Wing, I mean, yes, it's very talky and behind all. I do think it holds up out of some of the various late 90s shows, edge showing just kind of people actually walking around the Oval Office and trying to make sense of their new career opportunities.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's interesting you mention this because this leads into the final question. So just how do you guys think that this show changed TV and your perception of what TV is or what it was capable of. So, John, what do you say?
Kind of what I was saying before. Just there's a new level. I mean, you're gonna compare it to Sopranos. You're gonna compare it to Breaking Bad and The Wire. It's one of those. It's a staple. Like there's always these staples in movie eras and TV eras, and Sopranos is even with those great shows, Breaking Bad and The Wire. It just seems like Sopranos is that show, man. Like we were talking about, people already tried to replicate it, whether it was a mob movie or a mob show in the 20s or, you know, an English mob show. It's just something that people want to get back, just kind of in the same way when Seinfeld left. Everyone wanted to be in the next Seinfeld.
Right.
Yeah, and I really do think, you know, it wasn't just that it had so many imitators. It's the way that it pushed cable forward. It's the way that, you know, the streaming platforms have by and large said, well, yeah, we're going to at least have to try to be Sopranos level or something aspiring to that if we're going to succeed. Even basic network television realized that unless they're going to somehow excel at nearly purely episodic television, that just wasn't going to fly anymore, and people were going to demand a bit more psychological depth and patient storytelling, because The Sopranos, you know, despite the fact that it was on HBO, It had a huge audience and an even huger reach, even bigger reach, because people would hold Sopranos parties, people would record these episodes and pass them around, then the DVDs came out, and eventually, you know, after the show was over and streaming became a really big thing, people were streaming the episodes, and, you know, it's just been a big thing.
It was still around in the Blockbuster days, and you would get an entire wall at Blockbuster with Sopranos tapes. So I mean, it was bigger than, you know, it was bigger than Pepsi at the time. It was just something that everybody knew, and everybody was like, "Well, I'm gonna have to eventually watch this. I need to watch this."
Yep. So Cameron, thoughts?
Very well said. It definitely was just kind of, you know, the typical. I mean, people were already doing that years ago with stuff like, you know, Mystery Science Theater, Circulate the Tapes. But yeah, then the DVDs are coming out, and I would go to every other Blockbuster or even every other library. You know, the library would have the various VHS tapes, even as far back as I think 2008, and it was even more just wild how, yeah, it was almost always out of stock at every other video rental store. Everybody was renting it out for those who didn't have cable. And like you say, doing binge parties, that and 24 were totally embracing the whole DVDs, and pretty
24
much
especially.
Yeah, and everyone starts being more strategic, saying, okay, am I going to just watch it live every week and not miss an episode, or am I going to just, you know, bite the bullet and just splurge out, you know, $30-$40 to buy the set when it actually comes out? And it was just a lot of fun seeing that, as well as, you know, that's where, like you say, going back to the TV being treated like movies, you do start seeing a lot of, from that point forward, every TV show that wasn't, you know, made in the 90s would at least have some, you know, commentary tracks and special features, blooper reel. It was just a lot of fun seeing that much love being put into the home entertainment side of things. So, yeah. And like you say, I mean, I know we're going to talk about the upcoming movie. It's definitely one of those, the love for it never went away. There's still been some people who, on occasion, I would see just kind of diss it, say, oh, I can never get into it, unlike this other show it inspired, or why should I get into it? Because every other show has imitated it to death. And it's like, you know, it's the same thing with movies. I'm like, you still might want to check it out, even if you don't think it lived up to the hype, even if you're more in love with the stuff that other people were, you know, made because they were inspired by it. You know, just check it out. It won't hurt you.
Well, before we get into the movie and wrap this up, I just want to say I don't think any discussion of The Sopranos can be complete without giving nods to two women. First, to Lorraine Bracco as Dr. Melfi, and second, to Nancy Marchand as Livia Soprano. Nancy Marchand as Livia is one of the all-time great characters. To call her a villain, I think, is to belittle how complex a character she was. It's a damn shame that Marchand passed away before season three was really underway in terms of production, because there was a lot more that the show could have done with that character. And I just wanted to get your guys' thoughts on those two characters before we dive into the movie and wrap this up. So, John?
Lydia's really interesting, because I think David Chase pointed out that it was based off his mother. And I know a lot of women like Livia who are from that older generation, and they are charismatic. You can see how people are attracted to them, but they have this black hole and I think Tony has said that in some of the episodes, they have this black hole where they reached a point in their lives where they're just miserable. And I know Livia was, it seems like Livia was like that her entire life, but it seemed like it was something that escalated over the years and up to the point, you know, where she's going to talk with Junior and kind of set up a hit on Tony. But great storyline, great character, and I wish David Chase would write an entire book about her mother, because I'm really interested to hear how he grew up with, I mean, if Livia is anything like his mother, like how did he survive that mentally?
Lots and lots of therapy, according to him.
So he has been to therapy?
Oh yeah, he was very open about attending therapy sessions and that being part of his idea about, what if there was a mobster that went to therapy because his mother was a cruel woman like mine.
That is amazing. That is amazing. And then Lorraine Bracco, I mean, that's a TV show within a TV show. I mean, those scenes in that office. So perfect. I'm thinking about all the serious stuff, but the one thing that came to mind where Tony is telling Dr. Melfi about the mentally retarded kid in his neighborhood, and how Tony makes a joke out of it. But
yeah,
she keeps
trying to say, you mean mentally challenged, and
yeah.
Right.
Her character herself, her being involved in the project, I'm sure led a lot of, because I know that, I think they tried to get Ray Liotta for Tony Soprano at the beginning. And,
yeah, Ray Liotta wasn't sure about doing television at the time. And, you know, talking about casting Tony Soprano, the guy that played Jackie Aprile Sr., Michael Rispoli, I believe is the actor's name, he was the runner-up. And the second runner-up was Van Sant, who played Silvio. And believe it or not, the third runner-up was David Provol, who came in as Richie Aprile in season two. And James Gandolfini just absolutely blew all of them out of the water. But David Chase told every single one, look, we're not going to waste any of you. Stay in touch. We've got something for all of you. They immediately had Van Sant go for Silvio. That worked out. Rispoli, of course, got a few episodes as Jackie, starting in the pilot. They decided he'd be perfect for Jackie, but Provol, they couldn't find a role for him that season, but they decided to bring him in the second season. I even remember him giving an interview. It was either to Entertainment Weekly or TV Guide. He said, you know, I was one of a few fellows up for the role of Tony. Jimmy got it, but in the end, it didn't work out too bad for me. I got the gig eventually. And they said, the gig? He said, yeah, I got to be on the show. I'm working. That's what an actor wants to do.
Right.
That's
and
great.
Seeing how far he's come from, you know, prior to, you know, stuff like Mean Streets and The Siege and just all these other just bit parts. And he was like, it was an honor for him.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I mean, he only did like 7 or 8 episodes spread out over that season. But he's so memorable as Richie. Now, least of which because of the way Richie goes out.
Remember how he gets off. I just remember him kind of just being the Mikey of season two. But, yeah, he causes so much mayhem that season.
So is there anything any of you guys want to mention before we get into the movie?
Just really quickly about Tony and just basically how every character is seems like they're perfectly cast. Just the dedication of the actors. I mean, really one thing that always kind of, I don't want to say bothered me, but James Gandolfini was so into this character. I think it kind of led to his death, putting on the weight. And I think he put on the weight to try to match up with who Tony was and the greed aspect of him being a mob boss. And think that led a lot to eventually him unfortunately passing away at a very young age.
It's possible. I mean, you know, apparently CBS originally wanted to do The Sopranos, but they wanted so many changes that David Chase wasn't willing to go for it. And one thing they wanted was they wanted Tony to be played by a non-Italian. They wanted him to be, and this may be the origin of the line, they wanted him to be a, quote, Gary Cooper, Cary Grant type.
Oh, God. That would not
so,
have been
you know, yeah.
David used everything.
Oh, he absolutely did.
Everything in his personal life. I love it.
Yep. Now, Aaron White, who's been on the show several times, sent me an interesting article before the show, and that was where David Chase was giving an interview with some of the other cast members, and I believe it was being led by Alan Sepinwall, the famous TV critic, and David Chase mentioned that he plotted out the end of the show a couple years before, and he referred to the final scene in the series as the death scene. And then Sepinwall said, you do realize you just referred to it as a death scene, so are you finally saying, and Sepinwall apparently started to chuckle, and Chase looked around the cameras and said, look, you know what, fuck all you guys. I'm not saying nothing no more. You can forget about it. So I think that's kind of funny that you know, David Chase still to this day, you know, he it's a death scene, but it's not a death scene. I think to him he killed Tony off in terms of working on the show, but I never really bought that was Tony dying. I think it's the idea that you never know what's coming next, and things could end very, very suddenly, but life can still go on. So Cameron, you've been mentioning the movie, so you have some stuff to say about it. So this Sopranos movie, it's called Newark, right? And it takes place during the rise of Johnny Boy and Uncle Junior, correct?
I believe so, and I just think it's good that they're finally getting to it because, you know, the writer was, you know, the creators were ready to end it, and the fan base still wanted more. That's just how powerful it was, and it's just a good compromise at this rate. It's like, okay, do an origin story. This is the best possible origin story because there was always just some mystery to it that wanted to be a little unveiled, if you will, and it could definitely work better than, say, you know, all these, you know, countless, you know, movie franchises that just never seemingly end, and it's like the story's already ended, but there's still a part of it that fascinates that would work really well. I think very much like the Deadwood movie and, I mean, just various other stuff that's been asked, you know, for countless years that hasn't happened yet. I mean, even the El Camino movie would be a nice contrast.
I liked El Camino a lot.
Yeah. And it was just perfect because, I mean, it had enough of a standalone story for, you know, a newbie viewer as well as being a very key side story for, you know, hardcore fans. And it's like, okay, Walter's story's been told. Right now we're doing Saul's story, so let's just show what the hell happened to Jesse Pinkman because he kind of got ignored in the last 5 episodes. So, same thing with Tony. We've always wanted to see – I mean, I think it's a good idea that they decided to have Gandolfini's son, I think, is playing him, I believe. Is that still the case?
Yeah.
I don't know. I know that they were talking about that a while back, before they had started shooting it. Yeah. And Anthony's son has been doing quite a bit of acting lately.
Right. I think he worked with David Chase on a few other movies or shows. But yeah, it's just one of those. It's like everyone's been clamoring for it for quite a while, and there's so many other shows where everyone's asked. You know, like for Rome. It was like, when are you going to make a movie of that? And it's just not going to happen because it always comes down to the budget.
Yep, and here it is. Michael Gandolfini, I looked it up. Michael Gandolfini cast as young Tony Soprano.
Okay, perfect. So,
he's going to be playing young Tony.
And is it going straight to HBO or to the theaters?
That I don't see the information on.
It's the theaters.
Okay.
We will see, given you know, the state of things, good old land of Sequestria. I mean, you know, they still say that Tenet is going to come out in the theaters. Whew.
I just saw that it's getting pushed back again. All right. Well, I think this is just the perfect compromise. We've always wanted more of the Sopranos world. So it's like, again, just show us how he got to be who he got to be. Just like how some of these different fairy tale and horror character movies have done well based on showing a different side of that person or have it be from a different perspective. It's just going to be the ultimate reward, I feel. I think because the love for it has just never died down. There's always been new fans who have gotten into it because they're fans of other shows that have, you know, chronicle all these crime and terror. And, you know, Sopranos just, it's just the best way to end the legacy, you know? And, I mean, if HBO can just keep doing this, say, hey, it's time to acknowledge the stuff that got us subscribers in the first place, I think they'll have a bit more success because they've been on the Game of Thrones, you know, in True Blood train for just so long. It's like, it's time to move on, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I'm looking at the information here. It's called The Many Saints of Newark. Originally scheduled for September 25th, 2020. It's now been scheduled to March of 2021, directed by Alan Taylor, produced by David Chase and Lawrence Kohner, who wrote the script. Chase is very, very involved in this, with Alessandro Nivola as Dickie Moltisanti, also starring Leslie Odom Jr., John Bernthal as Johnny Boy, Corey Stahl, Michael Gandolfini, Billy Magnuson, John Majaro, Michael DeRosa, Ray Liotta, Joey Diaz, Nick Villagona, and as Livia Soprano, Vera Farmiga.
That's very interesting.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm fucking there. Even if it wasn't The Sopranos, I'm fucking there.
Very cool.
Yeah, yeah. This sounds like vintage. I mean, God, this is going to be pretty good. So, is there any last thing other than the fact we have to mention one more guy? How can we go the whole show and forget about Bobby Bacala?
I don't know. I don't know why I forgot him. I kind of know that him and Tony's sister, played by Ida Tesoro, are very well characterized, but just kind of come and go, if you will. They're just here and there. Sometimes even have a brief segment dedicated to them throughout season two and four. I had no issue with them. I thought they did their part. But it was just kind of a way to start off the show is like, whoa, we're at their house. And then we're going on to the main issue of the episode, which is, you know, Tony trying to launder money back.
Yep. And I still think Bacala has one of the best entrances in the show. Tony goes to meet Bacala. Bacala is supposed to give him some money and some information about Junior. And when Bacala gets out of the car lifts up. And Tony says, it's time for you to seriously consider salads. And Bacala just looks at him. And he's obviously not a fan of Tony. But when Tony leaves, Bacala goes, salads, what you talking about, you fat fuck? And, you got these two heavy set mob guys calling each other fat, getting pissed. And, you know, Tony is such an egoist that he doesn't seem to realize the hypocrisy and the cruelty. And, it's great. It's just like and in the Pine Barrens Barrens episode, you have Bacala showing up and Tony calls him Elmer Fudd because he shows up in the bright orange hunter's gear.
Right.
But
pretty wild.
Yeah, so I think that this is pretty much a wrap for this episode. I want to thank both of you for coming on, and I definitely would love to have either of you back again. And
thank you for having us be on here. And you brought up so many other good points and forgotten about characters and. Thanks for hosting.
yes. And before I go, because I will take us all out of the show in a second. But I believe that in terms of Deviant Legion Network news, I believe Carl Kafer has a show coming up this week.
Oh.
That should be Tuesday. And my show, Cathode Ray Mission, will be back next week. With what promises to be a fairly long episode on the career and films of Fritz Lang, or properly pronounced Fritz Long. And the following week will be a look at a series called MASH. So I hope that you listeners out there will join us again next week for Fritz Lang and the week after for MASH. But until then, I hope everyone has had a great time. I know I've had a wonderful time tonight. I want everyone to take care. And on the count of three, we'll all say good night. So one, two, three. Good night.
Good night.